This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Protests for racial justice erupted around the country earlier this year after George Floyd, a black man, was killed by Minneapolis police officers during an arrest. The video of George Floyd's final moments sparked outrage, and while many of the protests remained peaceful, tensions around the country were running high.
Good afternoon. I'm Jen Lask. We are following reports right now of break-ins and looting happening at Marketplace Mall, and I want to take you right to the scene. This is something that if you have been following us on Facebook Live, this is what we are seeing right now. This is just outside of Macy's. What we know so far from our reporters at the scene is that around 3 o'clock, a large group began gathering, and then they started breaking the windows.
That was a news clip from WCIA-TV on May 31st. Looting erupted that day at Marketplace Mall in Champaign. A 19-year-old Urbana man, Shamar Betts, was arrested days later for inciting a riot based on a video and flyer he allegedly posted to Facebook. He's still in jail awaiting trial, unable to post bond. Aaron Miguel Cantu is a journalist based in California and has been reporting on Shamar's story for The Intercept and Type Investigations. He says Shamar's story is just one of several where federal prosecutors are requesting pretrial detention. Aaron, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Michael Lodenthal. He's executive director of the Prosecution Project, an open source intelligence research platform that tracks felony criminal cases involving political violence in the U.S. since the 1990s. Michael holds a PhD from the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University and a master's degree in terrorism studies from the University of St. Andrews. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today.
Listeners, if you want to join our conversation, you can do so at 800-222-9455. If you have a question for one of our guests, the number to call, 800-222-9455. Aaron, can you start by giving us some background? Who is Shamar Betts? What has he been accused of?
Sure. So Shamar Betts is he's a 20-year-old resident of Urbana, and he had... before this year, he had been working as a counselor, teaching children appreciation for the environment, teaching them how to play chess. And I mean, he's just, you know, a young man. He grew up partially in Chicago. And when his mother passed away at 11, he moved to Mississippi to live with family there. And eventually he moved to the Champaign-Urbana area. And he, you know, lived a typical life before this year. And as a young black man, he had experiences with police and the criminal justice system that, you know, might be something typical for young black men his age. But he had never been convicted of a crime. He had never been sent to prison. This isn't a kid with a long rap sheet. And so this year, when COVID-19 happened, the hours at his job were reduced to zero. And as he told me, he was left with a lot of free time and, you know, was spending time on social media. He saw the video of George Floyd being murdered in Minneapolis. And he told me that he went to a protest one night. The protest didn't match the sort of rage and the pain that he felt, given his experiences with police as a young black man in America. And the following day, he posted a flyer to Facebook. The flyer mentioned the word riot, essentially asking for people to show up to a strip mall to protest and to riot. And he also recorded himself at that event. And given that ample amount of evidence online, federal law enforcement was able to locate him within a few days, and he has been in jail essentially since June 5th. He's still in jail as of today.
We have another clip to play here. As you mentioned, Shamar mentions the death of George Floyd in the post where he's alleged to have incited a riot. Here's what he said about how he was affected by the killing of George Floyd.
Think about it is, this could be a meme, he could be the majority anything, and that was a terrible way to die. So my first girl was scared. I was upset, highly upset, and disappointed. So with that being said, that's pretty much how I felt about the post. Well, I felt the George Floyd post once I seen the video.
So that was a little hard to hear. Can you recount for us what he was telling you there?
Sure. So, George Floyd, like many people in the U.S., Shamar Betz, like many people in the U.S., saw the video of George Floyd being killed, and he was enraged, and he was it pained him, just as, anyone with a heart and with a sense of empathy might feel. But I think it was also compounded by the fact that Shamar, as a young Black man in America, has, experienced the worst of a racist legal system. And, I think all of this sort of compounding with the pain that he's felt, in his own personal life. He told me that he, one of his best friends was killed by Chicago police in 2017. His mother passed away at 11, and this is something that also really aggrieved him. Since he was 11 years old, he's 20 now. With all of these experiences and watching this injustice, another thing that he posted, the Facebook post that is now being used against him in his prosecution, he wasn't, calling for some sort of like mindless, mob or something that was, not political. He says in his post, we experience inequality every day. We suffer here, in Champaign-Urbana every day. That's a paraphrase of his post. And so it's quite obvious that, whatever decisions he decided to make at that time as a teenager as well, he's 19 years old. It's coming from a place of deep hurt and deep experience. And so I think that's important to consider when you think about, the actions that he chose to take, and also the position that he finds himself in now, which is that he's been in jail for, half a year at this point.
Michael Lodenthal with the prosecution project. I want to bring you into the conversation now. Is Shamar's case unique from your perspective, or is this part of a larger pattern going on?
Sure. It's certainly part of a larger pattern.
There's no video.
Okay. We're not spending a lot of time looking at the individual prosecutions, because the nature of the prosecution project is to understand how individuals proceed through the criminal justice system in the aggregate. So, overall, looking all the way back to 1990, we're examining to varying degrees around 5,000 cases. When we zoom in specifically to look at what we in our project call the summer fall protest cases, we're looking federally at about 338 federally prosecuted cases and a very large growing list of non-federal prosecutions. So we have each case broken down, and we measure them on a variety of variables. We actually code them for 50 variables. And so we can look at Shamar's case specifically, but it really doesn't stand out in the aggregate. We have a lot of people being arrested on somewhat similar charges. If we look, just at Illinois or Chicago, we can pull similar data as well. So right now we're tracking 18 federal cases in Illinois, and of those 18 cases, 15 of them are in Chicago. I don't have much to add to his individual treatment. Not only have we not spoken to him, but we haven't dug into that case specifically. But what we're able to provide is a perspective nationally and regionally about what's happening with these cases. The degree to which people are being arrested in large numbers, when they're being arrested, their race and ethnic breakdown, age, gender, things like that. When we're completed in a few months, and once some of these cases have made their way a little bit farther through the court system, we'll be able to have more substantive findings, looking at what I would consider more interesting variables, such as, what motivated individual acts of criminality, why individuals were in the streets that day, what was targeted in their particular crimes, why they were targeted, motive and ideological variables. The challenge, as anyone who works in court reporting knows, is that when people are arrested, that kind of starts the clock. and it takes a very long time for people to proceed through the system. So we'll often track cases for years until we can say anything real substantive about it. So at present, it doesn't, Shamar's case doesn't stand out as anything odd, at least from a data sense, but it certainly fits well within this pattern that we're seeing of very targeted and heavily fortified cases against individuals, right? We're not seeing something that I think a lot of us expected, which is large mass arrests and large mass federal prosecutions. What we're seeing are mostly cases such as the one we're talking about, where individuals are arrested and a mountain of evidence is sort of put against them by prosecutors.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Michael Lodenthal, who's executive director of the Prosecution Project, as well as Aaron Miguel Cantu, who is an independent journalist and has written about the case of a Central Illinois man named Shamar Betts, who was 19 when he was posted on Facebook and has been charged with inciting a riot over some of the protests that followed the killing of George Floyd earlier this year. Cantu's piece is in The Intercept, and it's also reported for Type Investigations. Aaron, I want to ask about the charges. Do you have, I mean, you looked at not, I mean, you looked at Shamar Betts' case, but it was part of a broader look across the country. You know, we have this metaphor, don't make a federal case out of it, right? For when something is people are sort of blowing things up beyond their bounds. Why is this a federal case for something that happened in a shopping mall, a Facebook post that was presumably made in the same metropolitan area where the shopping mall is located? Do you have an idea of why this has become a federal case?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the simple answer is the reason that it became a federal case is because the federal government wanted it to be a federal case. Speaking to what Michael was talking about, you know, there's over 300 of these federal cases related to civil unrest, really since George Floyd was killed at the end of May. And my understanding from speaking with former federal prosecutors, federal public defenders, and other experts, is that the fact that these cases exist in the federal system in the first place is highly unusual. Typically, you have, in cases of civil unrest, prosecutors at the state level who pursue these charges. The fact that the federal government chose to pursue these cases signals that it is a priority for federal law enforcement to crack down on you know, what they perceive as civil unrest. And I mean, if we think back to the last 6 months of inflammatory rhetoric coming from President Trump, from Attorney General Barr, you know, it's been quite obvious since that weekend at the end of May that cracking down on, you know, quote unquote, looters, agitators, Antifa, anarchists, whatever, you know, whatever they would use to label folks who may or may not have been associated with this unrest, has obviously been a priority for this administration. And so some people, of course, you know, in the run-up to the election said that this was sort of you could call it like a law and order security, or I'm sorry, law and order theater. In other words, using aggressive prosecutions against folks associated with this unrest in order to drum up political support for President Trump's reelection campaign. So that's something that came up a lot. Even, you know, the fact that these prosecutions, all 300 of them exist in the first place is highly unusual. In our own investigation, we could only identify, under the previous presidential administration, under President Obama, we could only identify a handful of cases related to civil unrest that were prosecuted by US Attorney's Office across the country. And I mean, even looking deeper into past administrations, it's just not something that we found anywhere else. So I mean, the fact that you had hundreds of cases pursued in a matter of months by U.S. Attorney's offices across the country is really just unprecedented, and really is you know a sort of watermark in, I think, American history and the use of federal law enforcement executive power to go after folks for civil unrest. There's really no other precedent in modern times. And I think, you know, the last thing that I'll say about it is in my investigation, we also looked at instances in which U.S. attorneys' offices really aggressively sought pretrial detention, regardless of whether the defendant, you know, perhaps they don't have a criminal record, or perhaps they, you know, have a job or community ties, you know, and this would also include Shamar Betts. And all of those factors are supposed to weigh in favor of releasing a defendant ahead of their trial. There's multiple, problems that a defendant can face if they are in jail ahead of their trial. Generally, you know, studies have found that it's not favorable to them once they actually go to court and a conviction or a sentence and a judgment are rendered. And we found that, you know, in the districts in which U.S. attorneys' offices really aggressively sought pretrial detention, those U.S. attorneys were important to the Trump administration in some way. Some of them were working on investigations related to the Ukraine impeachment issue. Others were working on investigations into the Mueller investigation. So all of that just seemed to indicate that these were very politicized prosecutions, and the U.S. attorneys' offices that were pursuing these defendants most aggressively were, you know, they were folks who were also important to the Trump administration. They had, you know, significant positions within the Trump administration's Department of Justice. They worked closely with Attorney General Barr. So all indicating, I think, that, you know, these prosecutions, over 300 of them, as Michael said, you know, have a strong political element, which I found very troubling.
Okay, we need to take a quick break here. We're going to pause for a moment and then come back and wrap up this conversation after that break. If you can both stick with me, I'm speaking with Aaron Miguel Cantu, who's a journalist, and his piece investigating not only the case of Shamar Betts, a 19-year-old when he was arrested anyway, from Central Illinois, who's been accused of inciting a riot at a mall in Champaign. I'm also speaking with Michael Lodenthal, executive director of the Prosecution Project. We're going to conclude this conversation after a short break. Stay with us. This is The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking, we're concluding our conversation about Shamar Betts, who's a 20-year-old man from Urbana. He was 19 this past summer when he was arrested for and charged with inciting a riot. Federal charges based on a video and a flyer he allegedly posted to Facebook about looting that happened at Marketplace Mall in Champaign. This all followed the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. We've been speaking with Aaron Miguel Cantu, who's a journalist who's been writing about Shamar's story and other cases like it for The Intercept and Type Investigations, and also Michael Lodenthal, executive director of the Prosecution Project, which is an open-source intelligence research platform that tracks felony criminal cases involving political violence in the U.S. And just in a couple minutes we have left in this conversation, Michael, I wanted to ask you about, you know, sort of the broader perspective here. I mean, it seems clear, as we've heard and you've said and Aaron said earlier in this conversation, that the Trump administration was sort of encouraging this sort of prosecution. I wonder if you think that what you've heard so far about Shamar's case does fit the definition of inciting a riot. And then, you know, whether there's a possibility that a new administration in Washington might take a different view and we might see a change in course on some of these prosecutions.
Sure. I mean, certainly when we look at the prosecutions federally, again, we're looking right now at 338 federal prosecutions across the country. They are certainly occurring at an atypical rate, as Aaron said, and that's 100% correct. So, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, for example, is, you know, why some of these, you know, as you've asked, why some of these heavy charges have been levied. And so, for example, one of the things that we're able to see that, you know, we can point to specifically as sort of an anomaly are these selective prosecutions and these multi-jurisdictional cooperations. In other words, you know, crimes which would typically be prosecuted at the city or state level by a, you know, local police department are being prosecuted by a kind of, you know, a very tight nexus of federal agencies. So just in those cases that we're looking at, we see involvement, and again, this is involvement as reported by the Department of Justice, from the FBI, including its Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the U.S. Marshals Service, Federal Protective Services, the U.S. Park Police, Customs and Border Protection, the Department of Corrections, the U.S. Postal Inspectors, the Department of Homeland Security and its Intelligence Operations, the Homeland Security Investigation Center, numerous distributed national fusion centers, and a number of kind of various Department of Homeland Security affiliated offices. So for example, the New Jersey Office on Homeland Security and Preparedness. And this is to say nothing of obviously local police, sheriffs, and state police. And again, these organizations are being involved in not only the investigation of the crimes, but also the prosecutions of them. And so these things should be seen as atypical, because typically for a crime to rise to the level where it's prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office and through the federal government has to meet a certain set of criteria. And one of the things that Aaron and I looked at, a fair bit, is how many of these cases are being assigned sort of selective designations which make it easier to prosecute. And so in a lot of these cases, the individuals are being charged with violation of some manner of interstate commerce, for example. In other words, if someone sets fire to a car, they could be charged with arson. But if the federal government can argue that that car is used in interstate commerce, then that's arson interfering with interstate commerce. And what we see is that this interstate commerce is being used against dozens of people. I think at last count, we had over 80 cases, which would be about a third of the cases we're looking at. And so I can see the trends about how these are being prosecuted atypically. We can see the full weight of the U.S. federal government behind these. And if folks want to look at specific examples that are intriguing, for one, we have cases being prosecuted at the city level in Washington, D.C. through D.C. Superior Court by U.S. attorneys and prosecuted at a federal level. Again, we have similar instances in Portland where relatively simple crimes such as civil disorder are being prosecuted by the federal government. So I can say that any individual one of these cases we can pull apart, but when we look at these nationally, what we really see is a very intense effort to get convictions, right? We see this kind of, as Aaron said, this kind of law and order theater. I think that's a very apt way to explain it. And we see a lot of, anecdotal commentary from individuals saying that this is odd, this is atypical, or that they're receiving, in a sense, some sort of signaling to prosecute in this way. I don't think it's a accident that, in the latter months of the Trump administration, he really jumped upon this law and order, law and order, law and order chorus. That seems to really match really well with the actual prosecutions that we're seeing in the streets and in the courtrooms.
Very interesting. Okay, we're going to leave this conversation there. My guests have been Michael Lodenthal, who's executive director of the Prosecution Project, and Aaron Miguel Cantu, who's an independent journalist and has written about the case of a Central Illinois man named Shamar Betts for The Intercept and Type Investigations. I should also just note finally that Betts was at one point approved for pretrial release, but that was overturned by a more senior judge. There were people lined up to actually provide the money for him to get out, but he apparently has been ruled too dangerous to release by a federal judge. So this is a case we will continue to follow. I want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you both so much for sharing your reporting and knowledge with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.